This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville Tomorrow. You can get all the latest updates on growth and development and local politics at cvilletomorrow.org. And where should we start? Where should we start? We got a lot to get to today.
Well, you know, your previous guest was talking about state funding. And the challenge of funding core services in Virginia. Governor Kaine just announced his budget for Virginia. And Charlottesville Tomorrow has been watching the Board of Supervisors as they start meeting about their budget. That process has kicked off for local government. And Bob Tucker, the county executive, will be putting that together, much like Gary O'Connell's doing the same thing in the city. There's been a lot in the news about budget ideas on the city side, both in dealing with the surplus they've got and different initiatives that the city wants to move forward. A different conversation in Albemarle County. There's not a big surplus. In fact, there's a deficit that the county's trying to figure out how to address, given the housing market and assessments being pretty flat. It was interesting. In a work session, Coy, the Board of Supervisors all sat down with staff, and they really wanted to make sure they were on the same page about their assumptions heading into this budget. The big thing they are doing differently this time around is coming up with a five-year plan that's balanced. Now, in the past, only the one-year plan was balanced, because by state law, you have to have a balanced budget. And future years, both in the local government and schools, could go negative. You know, if you had initiatives and cost in out years, that wasn't seen as an immediate problem. And now what staff is asking them to do is have the discipline to agree on a five-year balanced funding plan, revenues and expenses.
That sounds sensible.
It does. And yet, given the revenue projections and assessments being flat, staff has had to come up with some adjustments to recommend to balance the budget over this five-year period. So just to give you some flavor of some of the things staff have done and said this to the Board of Supervisors.
And these are just some ideas that are being floated.
These are ideas for this five-year plan, and some of which will impact the current year's budget that they're building, but this is more five-year planning. Keep frozen 16 open positions. So county staff has 16 open positions.
Don't fill them.
Freeze those for 5 years.
And that means don't fill them.
Right. People and you know, as people retire, those positions would not be refilled.
And these are positions at the county office building, right? Or
could be in different places in county government. But and what the county staff are saying is we'd shift resources towards core services. So that was an issue. Is it Delegate McClellan?
Yeah, Jennifer McClellan.
That she mentioned.
And this is what all governments are having to do when you don't have as much money. You pull back and you focus on what you're really there to do. Public safety, education, yep. And transportation is often the big three.
Another big assumption for the next 5 years is to keep the tax rate where it is and only increase it. Right now it's at 68 cents. Increase it by 1 cent to 69 in the third year of the five-year plan. So that's a big assumption. Keep the tax rate where it is. A reduction in some of the transfer to the capital budget. That's another assumption. But a big one, no new initiatives beyond the things they're currently working on, except for public safety. So the supervisors were asked to react to this. You know, what do you think? And it was interesting. They each got little stickers, dots, and they could walk up to the wall and put the dots on the things they were most concerned about.
So all the ideas are up on the wall.
Right.
And the supervisors can walk up and...
Yep. So they all walk up.
Say, I like this or I don't like that.
Yep. Now, in this exercise, I believe supervisors Ken Boyd and David Wyant did not get up and put a dot on, because the exercise was put a dot on the assumption you're most concerned about. The other four supervisors put dots on no new initiatives. So they were concerned that an assumption was there wouldn't be anything new being done over the next 5 years. So then the
Does
next...
Does that include schools too?
No, this is just local government.
Okay,
funding.
So it's not a school budget.
And then, so given that they had something that they were not happy with, this idea that there would be no new initiatives, Lee Catlin, the county staff member, asked them to go back to the board and put dots on things they would revisit as a board. What are if the staff came up with these assumptions, you're not happy with them, what do you want us to revisit? And the two things that got dots were revisit some of the public safety improvements that have already been planned for. The one in particular they asked to relook at is the Pantops Fire Station. This is going to go up in the new Peter Jefferson Place near the new Martha Jefferson Hospital. So there had been a plan to build a fire station. Staff were already negotiating for the land, in fact. And the Board of Supervisors said, we may want to revisit that.
I imagine that has a big price tag on
it. It does, yep. And they were filling that fire station with full-time people.
Even bigger price tag.
and there was some discussion about how can we get more volunteers. So that was an interesting discussion. But the other thing that got three dots was let's revisit the revenue issue. And so that means not just looking at property taxes, but looking at other sources for new revenue. And certainly they've asked the General Assembly to help them out as much as they can. But and again, this is a conversation that will continue. This was not specifically focused on the first year. No decisions were made. Staff are going to come back to them as part of this budget process to let them know how they can make it all work.
Interesting. Now, what's the timeline on these budgets?
Well, Ian, in January, the work sessions will start. January, February, their work sessions, their public hearings. And, of course, we'll have that on our calendar at cvilletomorrow.org and let people know when those public hearings are taking place so you can go participate. Most of the work sessions are not – they don't allow public comment, so you wait for that one big public hearing to get that feedback in. But I would encourage the public who's has a budget issue they are concerned about to start writing the Board of Supervisors.
Speak up now.
Immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, by the time you get to the public hearing, there's a lot of water under the bridge. A lot of things have solidified in the negotiations.
Yeah, yeah. And, especially with a budget.
It's best to start early.
A lot of that stuff happens now. Yeah. And in the city, it's a similar process? All this will go down in January?
Similar process that the meetings start happening. I think around April is when, you know, tax rates are set and budgets are finalized and approved by May.
We're talking with Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville Tomorrow, online at cvilletomorrow.org. And next up, you have some news that you're not breaking here, but it was news to me. I did not know this. News, and that's I think that's big news.
It is big news.
Where
to me this morning. I'm looking at the Crozet Gazette, the December issue.
The Crozet Gazette.
Crozet Gazette. This is Mike Marshall's publication. He's the founder of this.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And it seems to be doing really well.
It's a great resource. Well, you need it. I mean, yeah. Crozet, I think, is big enough now. It needs its own little niche publication.
And on the front page, they're announcing that Ann Malik, the supervisor just elected from Whitehall, has already picked her planning commissioner. If the public doesn't realize this, that is one of the duties of a member of the Board of Supervisors. You get to pick your planning commissioner. And that person is going to be Tom Loach, who's a well-known Crozet resident, listener to this program.
He's been a guest
frequent
on this program. Yep, yeah.
Into this program. Might be listening right now. And if so, congratulations, Tom.
Now, that's big news. Why is this big news, Brian, you think?
Well, it's interesting. Tom was a candidate briefly for that seat. So he was going to be a third person in that race. He bowed out and, you know, tipped his hat to Ann Malik, endorsed her, and said that it would be best if he didn't split the vote. So that's one thing interesting about it. Going back in time even further, he was heavily involved in the master planning process out in Crozet. He lives in the growth area and has long thought that, you know, there needs to be a voice from within one of Albemarle's growth areas at the table on these decisions. So it's very significant. Now, Tom was also one of the strongest critics of the county when they started putting out the population numbers for Crozet early in 2006. And, you know, now he's going to be on the... He's going to be working directly with these staff that he's so strongly disagreed with this matter. And you know, I know Tom pretty well. I don't think that's going to be a problem. I'm not saying this is setting up a controversy, but it's just, you know, you look back over the past couple of years and everything that's happened in Crozet, and obviously the community made a decision when it put its support behind Ann Malik. This is one of the things that happens. If you elect new leadership, they're going to put new people in important places like the Albemarle County Planning Commission.
So the guy that David Wyant appointed, he will have to step down? Is
that's
that right?
That's right. His term will end December 31st. That's Dwayne Zobrist. And that's
the same guy who gave Dave Wyant, what, $10,000?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was interesting, too.
Well, that was a large gift. It was after he was already on the Planning Commission. I think this is, you know, we've got some interesting times ahead here. Ann Malik, you know, she's quoted in another article in the Crozet Gazette about some of her ideas, priorities about protecting the rural areas, protecting streams. I know Tom Loach has lots of ideas about the land use tax, and he's certainly going to be heavily involved in the review of the Crozet Master Plan. Master plans, Crozet was our first, come up for review every 5 years. And so Tom will now have a seat at the table for that to happen.
Wow, which is going to be really interesting because he probably knows that plan better than any other citizen. I mean, probably better than some of the county staff.
Now, there are a couple other seats up technically on the Planning Commission. And it's interesting, they are not advertising those seats. The only seat being advertised in the paper for applicants is the at-large seat, which is Marcia Joseph's seat. Now, I don't know.
Because she's stepping down?
She's not stepping down. My understanding is she will reapply for that seat. But since that's the one seat that all the supervisors, in essence, get to vote on and weigh in on, they're advertising that, I think, just to open the door to anybody who wants to apply. And that's a pretty routine process for that seat. The other seats on the Planning Commission, basically the supervisor puts in that seat whoever they want.
Right,
they don't
right.
have to accept applications for that position.
Right.
So the assumption then is that Petey Craddock, who represents the Scottsville District for Lindsay Dorier, will be back on the commission next year, and that Cal Thomas will represent Ken Boyd's will represent
the Ravenna
district for Ken Boyd.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. And they all, like the Board of Supervisors, they all start up afresh anew in January.
That's right.
After the holidays.
Yep.
And do you know what might be coming before them right off the bat? Some of the first things they might have to look at?
Well, one of the big things they'll be working on is Places 29. That will continue in 2008 as they shape those recommendations for the Board of Supervisors. That's one of the big things.
And for the folks who don't know, Places 29, it's sort of like a master plan for 29 North?
It's a 20-year plan for the 29 North Corridor.
And figuring out where do we want stores, where do we want neighborhoods, traffic lights,
that's
overpasses
right.
that we can't afford.
You know, a lot of people look at 29 North and say, oh, you know, what's left to plan? But actually, there's a lot. And it's redevelopment. It's transportation infrastructure, networks, parallel roads. And there is a fair amount of space that's not developed yet that we need to have a plan for.
Yeah. Interesting. We're talking with Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville tomorrow. He joins us on Tuesday afternoons to talk growth and development, the big issue here in Central Virginia, one of the very biggest issues. And that was certainly an issue in the recent elections, arguably the big issue. It was the elephant in the room for those elections for the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors. And we're learning more now about that election and the money that was spent on those campaigns.
For the first time this year, Coy, the Virginia Public Access Project has been tracking Albemarle and Charlottesville as two local elections in their online database. VPAP has traditionally done this for state races, General Assembly and statewide races. And it's so the community that's interested in campaign finance issues and transparency in politics has always gone to them as a resource. And now it's just really exciting that we can look at our local elections using that same tool, because it's allowing us to make statements about where the money comes from, how much money there is. In fact, I've totaled it up here. About $257,000 was raised by the seven candidates running in Albemarle County for supervisor.
For a little old Board of Supervisors races.
$257,000.
That's amazing.
So that was the total for all the candidates. The candidate with the greatest fundraising was David Wyant, who raised a little over $61,000.
The guy who raised the most money for his campaign lost. That's interesting.
It is. Now, of course, these totals could have easily been found, but things that were not easy to do in the past were to look at who the top donors were, what industries they represent, and things like that.
Yeah, for folks who've never been to VPAP, it is an astounding the level of detail that you can get into in looking at in following the money and looking at who's giving money to what political candidates. It really is fascinating because you can look at, you can find out their names. You can find out the names of the companies. You can search them by occupation. You can classify them in different, look at different regions, different zip codes?
You can search any individual who's made a contribution over $100, and they're in this database. So if you know one of your friends and you want to see who they're giving money to, just look them up.
Yeah. Or you can just go to a candidate and say, I want to see who gave money to Ken Boyd or to Marsha Joseph in the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors race, and it'll just spit out a list of people.
And it's all about transparency, and that's, you know, VPAP's mission is not to editorialize about the data, but just put the data out there and let people use it. And importantly, the media. So this is a resource for our local media, and I think an important one. It's going to allow us to keep an eye on this over time. And I think what we did at the end of the campaign, we reported on this throughout the campaign. But now that the campaign's over, we took the final set of fundraising data that got them through the election and put the top 14 donors up on our blog. And we sliced it a little differently than what you can do at VPAP. But we said, who are the top donors to all the candidates? Who gave more than $2,500, $2,500 or more, to any of these candidates? And we came up with 14 entities or people that did so.
And the number one on your list that gave a person or an organization that gave more money than anyone else or any other organization to candidates for the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors this year was something called the Monticello Business Alliance.
This is a political action committee. It's funded by the local real estate and construction interest in Charlottesville, Albemarle. The top donor to the Monticello Business Alliance, and again, this is all online, is Great Eastern Management. Great Eastern Management's run by Chuck Rotkin. That's the developer of North Point, which, of course, we were talking about on the show last week. Some of the other big players for the Monticello Business Alliance are Craig Builders, Southern Development, Faulkner Construction, Dr. Hurt, Better
Land
Living,
owner, yeah, developer.
Our Wade Builders. So it's groups like that. And that's
so literally the growth lobby. It's the phrase that I like to use. It's the people who want to see growth make their money off of growth.
And
they want to build it. They want to, you know, they want to see it happen. Let's build this, whatever it is, a apartment complex, a new neighborhood, shopping center. The Monticello Business Alliance represents the folks who want to see all those things happen.
They put $38,000 into our local election in the county, and the majority of that went to Supervisor Ken Boyd, who got about $18,500 from the Monticello Business Alliance. Dave Wyant got $11,000, and Lindsay Dorier, Democrat, got $8,500. So that's one example.
So none of the Monticello Business Alliance money, just to clarify, went to Ann Malik, who won.
Correct.
A seat on the board. Or Marsha Joseph, who was running against Ken Boyd.
That's right.
Interesting. Or any of those independent candidates who were running against Lindsay Dorier.
Right. Now, Marsha Joseph and Ann Malik did get a small amount of money from the real estate construction industry. So let's talk about that. We highlighted the top donor among all the candidates, but let's just look at the industry. And this is something that came out in some of the comments on our blog, but about 31% of all the contributions came from the real estate construction industry.
Total. Anybody.
$257,000, 31% of that is from the real estate construction industry, according to VPAP. And
so a third of the money, just about, you know, rounding off here,
yep,
a third of the money in the local campaigns for the Board of Supervisors was the growth lobby. Realtors, developers, builders. Wow.
And
I knew it was a lot, but I didn't know it was a third.
And of the candidates who received that money, Mr. Boyd, the current chair of the Board of Supervisors, 49%, half of his funding came from that industry. Mr. Wyant, Dave Wyant of Whitehall, 45% of his funds came from that industry. And Lindsay Dorier, 45% as well. Now, Joseph only had $3,500 or 7.4%. from real estate and construction, and Ann Malik had $500 or 1.2% of her funding. So that's another
versus
way.
Versus 45 or 49%.
Correct.
For the other
guy. So that's another tool that you can use on the VPAP website is look at it by industry. You can look at it by individual or by a political action committee that's contributing to these races. You know, Coy, we were talking last week about the City Planning Commission and about impartiality and who should be recusing themselves from decisions about, you know, the mall crossing in Charlottesville.
Right, right.
And money doesn't come up that much in the city of Charlottesville. It's and the reason is that the money is small in the city council election, and it's one party in this most recent election, and there wasn't a lot of fundraising. The political party gave money to the three Democrats, and that was the bulk of the funding.
Yeah, and the election really was the firehouse primary convention or whatever that that's when the Democratic candidates are chosen, and they didn't have any Republican competition. There were two independents who I thought were saying some very important things in that race that perhaps should have gotten some more attention, but that's just my opinion. But they lost, and the three Democratic candidates won seats.
So that's one reason why money doesn't come up as much. But I think, you know, one of the things I would ask the community to think about, and that I'm thinking about personally, and I don't have the answer to this, but is now that we have this information about where money comes from, what is our expectation about how that will be discussed in the future? So if a developer, and we don't have to name any, but if a developer made a contribution to a candidate, does that candidate, if they are on the board and have one of those applications in front of them, do they have to disclose that at a minimum, or do they have to go further and recuse themselves? That's not something I've really observed in Albemarle County.
It doesn't happen, does it?
And, well, I can't think of a case
where
Ken
Boyd wouldn't say, somebody, some developer comes before him, Ken Boyd wouldn't say, I've got to recuse myself from this because I got huge donations from this developer, or I'm going to vote on this, but I got to let you know I got big money from this developer. That does not happen now.
And let's, you know, use another example.
And the question is, should it happen at all?
There's an environmental group. I'll call them an environmental group. It's Citizens for Albemarle. They gave two donations, one to Ann Malik and I think one to Marcia Joseph. Should, if a change to the zoning ordinance related to rural area protection, which this interest group may support,
right,
should and Ann Malik have to identify that contribution and recuse herself from a vote? I'm not saying I know the answer to that, but I think it's interesting that we've been discussing this in the city, and now now that we have this data, maybe we should be discussing it more in the county.
Because we have access to this information about who's spending what kind of money on what candidates locally. You're used to seeing that nationally, but now we can see it locally for Board of Supervisor candidates. We have really, you know, access to this because of the internet, really easy access to this kind of information for the very first time this year. And so it's a great question. Well, what does that mean then in the future when issues come before this Board of Supervisor and we now know as a community that they got a lot of money from this guy, or they got a lot of money from an interest group which supports this guy? Very interesting. Or woman. Yeah. It's an interesting question. I don't have an answer either.
You know, the only experience I can give is that, you know, as a member of the school board, and we typically don't talk about my school board experience, but just to give a real example, you know, the Biscuit Run development came in front of the school board, and we had to talk about where was the most appropriate place for a school in that development. And I disclosed at the beginning of the discussion that Hunter Craig had supported, you know, my first campaign for school board. And that was done before Biscuit Run was even purchased, and, you know,
Hunter Craig, the developer of Biscuit Run.
But again, I think that's the side that maybe you err towards that side of just disclosing things and make your case, you know, that, hey, this is why it's not an issue in this case, or here's why it is an issue and I'm going to recuse myself.
Yeah, I think you should always, as a public servant, somebody in the public, and people know, we know now more easily that, you know, person X is giving money to you. I think you should always err on the side of openness and disclosure. It doesn't mean you necessarily have to recuse yourself from a vote, but you should always err on that side of openness and, hey, I just want to let you know, whatever. That you should always be more open with that kind of information. Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville tomorrow joins us on Tuesday afternoons to talk growth and development. And big news, more news coming out of Albemarle County about a new church. Is that it? Is it one of those mega churches?
Well,
are we going to have our first big mega church?
I don't think we have that. But what's interesting, Coy, is we've got a number of church applications coming before Albemarle County government. And we're seeing a trend here. These are churches that want to expand. In some cases, it's a small startup church, and they've outgrown, you know, the temporary location they were in. In other places, and it's an existing church that wants to expand. They don't have enough parking. And what we're seeing is they are finding the land in the Albemarle growth area too expensive. So they're looking out to the rural countryside as a place to put their church.
And so they go before the board to seek like a special use permit.
They need a special use permit
to build where you're not allowed to build.
Right. Well, and apparently a community gathering spot like a church is allowed, but I guess you need a special use permit. It's interesting. There's a federal law that prevents Albemarle County from really denying these applications. I mean, if you just boil it all down.
So if you're a church,
this is called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act.
When does that date to?
And my colleague at the office, Sean Tubbs, has been doing the work on these two stories. But we did a series that are up on our blog. One was Grace Baptist Church, which was in front of the County Planning Commission. And then First Church of the Nazarene was in front of the Board of Supervisors.
My great-grandfather was a Nazarene minister. I'll just throw that in there.
Well, if he was here, his new church would be out in Keswick. And if you go out Route 250 and you pass Luck Stone on the right, and there's a little gas station.
On the left.
There's a little gas station. Well, Luck Stone's on the right.
Oh, yeah.
If you're heading towards Richmond.
Yeah.
Luck Stone's on the right. On the left is the little gas station and Route 22. And you can turn left there.
That's where the
triangle.
And the road splits there, right?
Yeah.
On the right, you go down to that rich neighborhood with the gate. And then
Glenmore is further down.
And then on the left, you go up north to...
Towards Keswick.
Yeah. And Gordonsville and the traffic circle.
And this church has been approved 5-1 by the Board of Supervisors to be on that little island between I-64 and 250. Right against... If you turn up Route 22, there's a little... I think it's a wine shop. There was a little retail strip right there, and it'll be directly across the street from that.
Wow.
Now, the neighbors in the area were quite concerned about this, because certainly...
You mean they didn't rush out and welcome this new development with open arms?
No.
Like folks in the rural area always do?
They didn't, and that's the rub here. You know, you've got a church that wants to grow, needs more space, it can't afford to be in the growth area. There's other churches have been approved in the rural area in the past, so there's sort of a precedent. And then there's this federal law, and all these things combined have got people scratching their heads right now saying, what are we going to do about this? Now, again, these projects are moving forward on Grace Baptist Church. That was deferred by the Planning Commission. They're going to keep working on that one. That one is proposed to go up on Watts Passage Road, which is up in northern Albemarle. But this First Church of the Nazarene is going to be a 374-seat, what they call a multi-purpose center. So it's not just a traditional church, but they also want to have it as a community center. In particular, they want to support youth basketball programs and other youth programming.
But so it's going to be a gym and a sanctuary?
Gym and a church, yeah, apparently.
How do you have well, I guess you could just figure it out. Folding chairs, there you go. That'll work.
And if it's more glamorous than that, I apologize to those congregation members.
It's interesting that we're seeing these churches come growing. It's a good sign for the churches in this country that we're seeing them come forward and, hey, we need to grow. We need a new church. We got to build something.
Well, it's part of a growing community. I mean, one of the things I think we need to think about is where is the appropriate place for these things? When Ravenna Village was approved, which is adjacent to Glenmore, that's the biggest part of the growth area that was just recently approved at Glenmore.
Right. Yeah.
In the plan is a public building for a church. So the developer sort of penciled in, hey, here'd be a good place to put a church. So it's good that in my opinion, that
he's not going to build it, but he's just saying
would be a good parcel.
If the county wanted to put a church here,
you
could
sell it for that use.
Yeah.
North Point.
Why aren't they building this Nazarene church down there then?
Well, I don't know if that space was also viewed as too expensive.
It's right down the road, isn't it?
It is right down the road. Maybe it was too expensive. Maybe it was too small. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think that's what we need to look into as a community. You know, if you drive around downtown Charlottesville, one of the things that always catches my eye are the steeples. And I would encourage the public to start looking for those things because they really help define a lot of the downtown feeling you have. And, you know, you think about old rural churches that we have and how special those
are. Yeah, they're beautiful.
But now what we're seeing is the move towards not small rural churches, but bigger rural churches.
Yeah, we're not quite mega churches yet, Liberty University style, but...
Right.
But we're seeing bigger churches as compared to 100 years ago.
So this conversation will continue again. We've got Sean Tubbs wrote two great stories that are up on the blog and would encourage people to look at them.
SeaVilleTomorrow.org. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.